Welcome to Public Purpose Conversations, brought to you by IPA Tasmania. Welcome to IPA Tasmania's Leadership Podcast Series. I'm Melanie Brown. I'm the current president of IPA Tasmania, and I am absolutely delighted to be able to welcome today a very special guest. In many ways, he needs little introduction. As the state's 46th premier, who led us through the COVID-19 pandemic and has since stepping down from politics, continued to lead the way by advocating passionately for men's health and well-being. I'm speaking of none other than the Honourable Peter Gutwin. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Mel, it's my absolute pleasure.
We're here to talk about your leadership journey and the things that motivate you in life. I'm interested to understand whether you've always aspired to leadership or whether you felt that it was thrust upon you, as they say.
Look, I'd be in the always aspired to leadership group. I do believe, though, very firmly that that leaders are made, not born. You know, I think the skills of leadership can be taught to anyone. And I think there are, without doubt, many effective leaders. There is a difference, though, between an effective leader and somebody that's an inspirational leader that will take people with them as well. Across my journey, it's interesting. People would remember me as the premier. That was probably, in fact, without doubt, my most high-profile leadership role. But throughout my life, I worked in senior management positions. I ran small businesses which have a leadership aspect to it, and obviously played sport and was captain of this, that, and the other. And so, leadership has always been a part of my life. I like to think that the lessons that I learnt stood me in very good stead for when I did become premier, especially with the challenges that we had at that particular time.
Was leadership something that was big in your family?
No. Look, my father left school when he was 12. He's no longer with us. He was an unskilled migrant to this country. I was a young child when we came here. And my father, worked in a range of different jobs, from weaving to baking, cut firewood. He did finally land himself a job with the fire brigade. In fact, he was turned down by the Tasmanian police because he didn't have the necessary levels of English. But the fire brigade at the time were hiring, and he got a job there. And he did go on to become a station officer. But leadership was never something that he coveted. He just worked very hard. He wanted to provide for his family, and he did it as best he could.
So your journey through your career has not been linear. Starting out at 15, you went and got yourself an apprenticeship. You were passionate about sport, and then somehow you made your way to politics. What does that journey look like for you, and where did a penny drop in terms of you wanting to actually represent the community?
Look, I dropped out of school when I was 15 because I wanted to chase a dream, and that was to become a professional footballer. Yeah, my background, or a family background, was one of very meagre social means. Yeah, today we would have been called poor. Six kids, parents that were migrants, unskilled. Our shop of choice as children was the local op shop here in Launceston. And I very much remember getting my first pair of football boots there and just thinking, how good is this? There was a whole range of what was then Adidas football boots, and just thinking how fantastic this is. I just wanted more as a child. And as I grew, I just wanted more. And I saw a trajectory, a pathway to becoming a professional sports person as one way that I could achieve that. And so I dropped out of school and focused on that, and then was fortunate enough to be picked up, and I was taken on into the insurance industry in my early 20s. And they had very strong training programs, both in terms of leadership and management, but also sales. And that stood me in great stead as I moved through the rest of my life.
We all appreciate that leadership comes in all shapes and sizes. Leading can be about influencing, it can be about supporting, it can be about towing a hard line. What, in your view, are the most important characteristics of a good leader?
Look, the first thing I think that's really important is authenticity. People don't believe in you, then they're not going to follow you. I think a leader has to be a good communicator. And that's not necessarily, in front of a microphone. It can be in terms of the conversations that you have with people quietly as individuals. A leader has to take responsibility. In many cases, people say they respect people, you know, that portray a buck stops with them attitude. And that's not something that you can tell people that's the case. People need to sense that and feel that you're that type of person. But I think the authenticity, the responsibility aspect are really important, because people will soon work out whether you're real or not. And most importantly, you've got to be able to lead yourself. If you can't lead yourself, you won't lead others.
That's I think, an excellent recipe for a good leader. Just picking up on your point about the buck stopping with people, leaders can often forge a reputation for either being those that stand for a cause and stand come what may. Others are known for being leaders that achieve resolution through compromise, so looking for the win-win outcomes. We all appreciate that life comprises a bit of both of those. You've got to know when to hold them, and you've got to know when to fold them, as a very well-known song says. As a leader, what do you think are your proudest achievements on both sides of that coin?
Look, one thing, I guess in terms of leadership attributes that I didn't mention, was that leaders have to have courage. You've got to be prepared to do things that you're frightened of. And yeah, when I look at what I would consider my proudest moments as a leader, that was when we made a decision and set a goal within government that we wanted to save as many Tasmanian lives as we possibly could through COVID. And that meant making some pretty big calls before the rest of the country was ready to make those calls. You know, we stopped cruise ships before the rest of the country had. I closed the borders before anyone else in the country had taken those steps. And all those decisions, the consequences of making them, I was well aware of. You know, I was going to impact on travel plans, businesses, the way that people live their lives. But I took the view that the risk was worth it, because at the end of the day, if we could stop that virus at our border, then we could save people's lives.
Now, that pandemic was hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime event. And as you say, it did require incredibly strong leadership and fortitude to be able to make those sorts of decisions. It also took an enormous amount of collaboration across communities, across decision-makers, across the globe. Looking back, what do you consider to be the most important takeaways that you have taken away from that period of your life and your time as the leader of a state? And what do you know now that you wish you'd known then?
Look, it's interesting. In terms of takeaways, in a leadership sense, you need to be decisive and you need to be clear in your communication. And that doesn't matter whether it's trying to stop a pandemic or whether you're trying to run an office. Yeah, people need to know why you're doing it, and importantly, that it needs to be communicated clearly. One of the proudest aspects of the outcome of the pandemic, especially when we were really up to our neck in it, was the sense that Tasmanians held out their hands to each other and helped each other. It was the most extraordinary expression of humanity that I've ever seen. I had people from different backgrounds, different walks of life, that were just prepared to do what was necessary to help each other to get through. And when I look back, I'm so very proud of that. You know, I hope that some of the language, some of the communications that we were doing as a state were helping people to get to that point. But it was just extraordinary. It was the most beautiful expression of a common humanity that I've ever seen. The other thing that, in terms of that, I learned through the pandemic, and I think, and it's something that I forgot at a personal level, and I used to say this regularly to my cabinet and in the past other leadership groups that I've been involved in. Julius Caesar said that an army's greatest weapon is rest. And during the pandemic, I know I caught myself out on a couple of occasions where I didn't heed that message. I know that there were others, and the public sector should be so very warmly congratulated for its efforts during that pandemic. I could not be prouder of the people that I worked with. It was just extraordinary. It's a public service, and for that period of time, over those couple of years, the public were extraordinarily well served by those that were employed by government. But making certain that you rest, that you are mindful of where your head's at, where your body's at, is so important when you're a leader. And as I say, it doesn't matter whether you're managing a pandemic, running a football club, running an agency. At the end of the day, to perform at your absolute best, you need to be in good shape to do that.
Leaders do play a key role in shaping the culture of organisations, and to a large extent, they shape the working environment. What, in your view, are the most important elements that a leader, whether of an organisation, of a team or a community, can contribute to ensure the well-being of others?
In terms of what you communicate, it's so very important to say that it's okay not to be okay. Let's have that conversation. Let's talk about those things that are necessary. One of the people that that I admired, he's no longer with us now, unfortunately, was a guy called Barry Jarvis. He was the mayor of Dorset. And what was interesting, and I well recall this, as a young parliamentarian, I wasn't in government. I owned a pub for a period of time in the northeast, and I think at the time we probably still did. And there was a spate of youth suicide. And that was really impacting across the Dorset community. And Barry, as mayor, was prepared to actually raise this issue publicly, to actually make the point that it was okay not to be okay, but let's have the conversation, let's put in place the supports. And he actually changed the thinking across that municipality, because he was brave enough to talk about a difficult subject, and one that, you know, some experts will say that you never should raise it, but he did, and he communicated in such an effective way that there were great outcomes. I just think that in terms of the work that people do and the pressures of life that they have, it's important that every workplace, every organisation has a clear understanding that it is okay not to be okay, and that, you know, we can support you, and that that we'll work our way through these things. And I think that's really important that the leaders are prepared to express that.
I think we've come a long way, haven't we? Absolutely recognise that the mental well-being of the people within an organisation can make or break the productivity of that organisation. Will have an impact on the outputs, will have an impact on the outcomes. And when working in public service, there's always a recognition as well that we reflect the community that we serve. And so if you're setting a standard, if you're ensuring that you are looking after your people, then hopefully there will be a sense of confidence within the community more broadly that government is about looking after the community as a whole.
Look, absolutely. I think, and it's more than a trickle-down effect. You know, I think if government takes a leadership position and is prepared to clearly communicate, you know, those key messages, then that's heard by all aspects of the community, all sectors of the community. And you know, it's important that those conversations occur. It's important that those messages are clear. And you know, there's again, you know, if I come back to this point, if you know, if government has an aim that it wants a community that's well, it needs to lead from within itself. It's pretty simple.
Absolutely. Now, we're living in a very fast-paced and changing world. I think it's fair to say that in sort of recent decades in particular, the vortex has probably sped up in terms of the things that communities expect from their governments. Our institutions are built on integrity, frank and fearless advice, public value, the impartial ability to implement the agenda of the government of the day to reflect the will of the people. You've heard all of those, I'm sure, as someone with a very long career in Parliament. I'm interested to understand your reflections on the public service, and I acknowledge that you commended the public service for their efforts through the pandemic. What do government agencies and their leaders need to do to remain relevant, to best support the community and to deliver good outcomes into the future?
Well, that's a really good question. Let me just frame up my answer this way. When I was in opposition, I had a completely different view of the public sector. And in fact, I came to government back in 2014 with a view that I was going to cut and hack my way into it and find a whole heap of savings, and that these public servants and bureaucrats, you know, better look out. Coming to government, I was privileged to have been supported and served by some of the finest individuals that I've ever met. You know, and I look back at the secretaries of any number of departments, the senior leadership teams, those that I worked with in respect of the different ministerial roles I had, it would be fair to say that privately, the conversations that I would have with my spouse or with those people that were my close confidants were that I was working with some of the most brilliant intelligent, hardworking individuals that I'd ever come across. And I think that's something, you know, in terms of the recognition and acknowledgement that the public sector doesn't get, I think there should be more acknowledgement of the work that goes on. In terms of how the public sector can best serve government, that frank and fearless advice is so very important. Now, you put together, and I can speak as a premier, you put together a ministry that's made up of people of different capabilities, capacities, educational background. It is important that the advice that they receive from their departments and from their advisors is the best that they possibly can receive. Sometimes departments will need to support ministers more than others. But again, what from my experience, the capacity that exists within the Tasmanian Public Service is one which we should be forever grateful for. That's not to say that they are perfect, but my overarching reflection and recollections of the time that I spent working with the public service are nothing but good.
I'm sure there are going to be some very grateful public servants out there for your recognition of how challenging it can be sometimes working in the sausage machine of the bureaucracy. I'd like to get your perspectives on leaders that have impacted or influenced you. Who would you identify as a leader you most admire?
Well, that's a great question. Look, and there are a number of them that I can think of straight off the top of my head. Look, in the sporting space, Craig McRae, I think, is just brilliant in terms of what he's been able to do with that Collingwood group. He's got a few issues in front of him now, but I'm sure he'll work his way through that. Meg Lanning, Elise Perry, Sam Kerr have just been fantastic ambassadors for their code. They've paved the road for others to follow, and I think that's just brilliant and demonstrates both their skill and ability, but their personal leadership qualities as well. Obama, I just thought was brilliant. I remember pulling off the road when he gave his first, I think it's the State of the Union address, because I was just so captured by the way that he could sell hope and vision and promise. One of the world's greatest ever orators. And in the Australian context, John Howard, I thought, was a very dependable, consistent, but brave leader. Paul Keating brought other skills to the table, and who could forget the Redfern speech? And then Bob Hawke, when I was younger, growing up, albeit on a different side of politics that I ended up on, he took the country with him on some big issues. And obviously, during COVID, one person that I thought did a fantastic job with a small nation, and that was Jacinda Ardern. You know, she undoubtedly saved lives, and importantly, she took the country with her. Now, she's being judged on other things at the moment, but setting that aside, I thought that she was fantastic in that role that she had during COVID.
Now, you're well known for your martial arts skills. You're also well known, I think, for your dedication and your discipline and your willingness to work on things. I'm going to use a martial arts analogy in deference to your taekwondo qualifications. What leadership skills do you consider yourself to have a black belt in, and where are you still working through the colour rankings in your mind?
It's a very good question, Mel. Look, what I should do is just step back and just say, in terms of the martial arts, like, you never stop learning, and a black belt's just a part of the process. The skills that I'm most proud of that I think that I've developed are an ability to communicate. I like to think that I've made some courageous decisions over time. Now, that's not to say that I'm not cognizant of risk and understanding of how to assess risk. But for leaders, I think you've got to be prepared to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. And leaders need to be brave. The other skill is taking responsibility. I've never, ever shied away from saying, well, the buck does stop with me. I would never push somebody under the tram to take the hit for me. At the end of the day, I'll wear the decisions that I've made. But like with all things, and especially communication skills, we are learning every day, and we should be looking to improve ourselves and take that step forward. Now, albeit if it's just a minor turn of the dial, we need to be looking for that improvement, just the same as a martial artist, regardless of what belt colour.
What a great reflection. Now, leadership can take its toll, And the importance of that balance of well-being is something that we've already touched on. There's a need to obviously strike a balance between supporting people and getting the job done. It's often far easier to say that we need to stay balanced and we need to look after ourselves than sometimes it is actually to implement. You were very frank in explaining your reasons for stepping down as Premier when you made the decision to depart in early 2022. And you highlighted the need as a leader to give 110% to the role of Premier, and you having the realization that you had nothing left in the tank to give. Do you think giving everything is an unavoidable sacrifice that leaders often or sometimes have to make? Or in your reflections since leaving public office, do you think there is a way even for leaders to strike a balance and have it all? It's a bit like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, I think.
And thank you for that question. I think it's a really important question. On reflection, I do believe that in my own personal case, there were things that I could have done differently, should have done differently, that would have enabled me to have been a better leader and perhaps not have put me in the position where I felt that I had to make a choice between my family and my health and a career that I really love. The concept of accretion, the gradual layering up of responsibility over someone's life as a leader, is something that really needs to be understood. I always have believed that the reward for doing a good job is a bigger job, if you want to take it. And if you're ambitious like I was, you'll always take that bigger job. But what happens is that with that bigger job comes a higher level of responsibility, more of an impost on your own time. There are things in your life that you need to set aside and perhaps focus less on. Now, over the course of my parliamentary journey, and the concept of accretion is one that my wife and I talked about just prior to me stepping down. When I first joined the parliament, I thought I'd be away from my northern home about 15 weeks of the year. When I became a shadow minister, I was away around 20 weeks of the year. Then I became treasurer and held multiple ministerial portfolios, and that took me up to between 35 and 40 weeks of the year away from home. All of this was happening without us really giving any thought to it. We were just happy, or I was happy with the career progression. My wife was happy that I was happy. But what it meant was that over time, it was a little bit like boiling the frog. We just didn't realise that this massive change was occurring until it got to the point where I became Premier and I spent the better part of 45 to 50 weeks of each year away for the 2 years I was Premier. And my wife said to me that week in March, the week before I stood down, we were in COVID isolation. One of my children had COVID and I'd been sent home. And she said, on day five, tonight's a night for a celebration. I said, well, why is that? She said, well, we're getting the champagne out. You've now spent five consecutive nights under this roof with your family, and that's the longest period in 2 years. And it hit me like a train. And by that evening, I'd made up my mind that I was going to change things and leave the parliament and focus on my family. Now, that accretion that had been occurring, if I'd taken the time annually to actually reflect, to consider how I could better balance my life, I would have been, I think, a better leader, a better father and a better husband through that period. But I never took the time to step back. And so I think, yes, you can have it all, but you need to be prepared to do that necessary period of reflection on at least a minimum of an annual basis, just in terms of how the balance in your life is operating.
I appreciate how very difficult acting out that kind of approach would be in the context of the pandemic and, as you say, the requirements placed upon you, the expectations, whether tacit or quite overt, to be the face to turn up, it can be very challenging to strike that balance. You've been away from politics now for 2 years. I'm wondering how the tank's going. Have you managed to refill it? What has been your recipe for success?
Well, one of the first things that I did, and I should say, and I make this point, I make it, I speak a lot publicly when questions are asked about what I'm doing at the moment and where I'm at. I always make the point, I do not receive a ministerial or a parliamentary pension. And I just want to be clear on that. We'll see letters written to the paper if I speak on subjects and people say, oh, it's okay for him. He's actually on the crown shilling and what's he got to worry about? Well, no, I don't. When I stood down, being a 2002 starter in the parliament, that was post all of that pension matters. I get no better superannuation than anyone else. So when I stood down, I had to find a way to make a living. Now, I was in reasonable shape financially, so we're able to take the time to think those things through. One of the things that struck me, and I read a lot of books during the period, I won't go through the titles of them, but in one of them, it just made the simple point that there are 168 hours in every week. You know, surely you can find 7 of those hours, 1 hour a day, to focus on yourself. And so I started very shortly after stepping down on setting aside an hour of each day just for me, and that whether that be physical training, meditation, looking at the learnings that I wanted to achieve. I do box breathing, those sorts of things, just to actually have a little bit of me time. And what I found is that has put me in such a great place in terms of my own personal well-being, that I am a better husband, I'm a better father, and I now have pretty much a full dance card in terms of work. In fact, more than what I had ever reasonably hoped to have, and I need to make certain that I manage that and it doesn't get out of shape. But if you just swing back to the definition of well-being, which really is, how do you feel about yourself and how do you feel about your life? I've never felt better, and I've never felt my life has been going better than where I am at the moment.
That's fantastic news. You're not only obviously walking the walk in terms of your own health and well-being on all fronts, you've also become well known for your passion around improving health and well-being outcomes for men and advocating for men to live better, longer, fitter lives. How are you doing this and how are you making progress on that challenging front?
Well, it's interesting. When I first stood down as Premier and I had a little bit of time on my hands, I started to meet with a few of the different coffee groups that were going around. And when I stood down, I was 57 years of age. And you know, to be fair, most of the coffee groups were a little bit older than me. But I was staggered by the number of people that were facing up to heart disease, had issues with their lungs, hips and knees, and in many cases, and I note that the ABS stats, I think, which came out earlier this year, indicate that, you know, in Tasmania, we've got a higher proportion of overweight and obese adults. In fact, I think it includes children as well, a population, a higher percentage of overweight and obese adults, around 70% of the population that falls into that. And in these conversations that I was having around the table, in fact, many of the people I was talking to would have fit into the ABS definition of being in that position. And I thought, wow, like I need to make certain that at the personal level, the next 30 years of my life are going to be the best 30 years of my life. And one way that I can do that is if I improve my health and well-being and importantly my fitness. And so I threw myself into that. I don't mind saying I'm actually 16 kilos lighter today than I was when I was Premier.
That's very impressive.
And what I've started to do is build into all of the speeches that I've been giving a small piece on well-being. I'm not evangelical about it, but I just think that it's an opportunity to say to people, look, just take the time to have a think about what the next decade, 2 decades, 3 or 4 decades might look like and how you might be able to improve that if you're a little bit fitter and healthier.
That is a very good thought piece for people to take away from this conversation, I think. Peter, I'm really appreciative of your time. I hope that you have got fabulous plans for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years. You've done an incredible service for this state in leading us through the pandemic and because of your long tenure as a Member of Parliament and a representative of the community. So thank you very much for your service. It's been an absolute delight to have a conversation with you today.
Well, thank you very much. I've really enjoyed the opportunity.
Brought to you by IPA Tasmania. This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Kanamaluka people in Launceston. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal people and recognise the ongoing custodianship of the Palawa people across the island of Lutruwita, Tasmania.